You don't have to be good at numbers to be good at math.
You don't have to be like a mental calculator in order to understand and be actually really good at math. And I think the way that our math education system is set up in the US, but also in a lot of places, sort of make you feel bad if you can't do that stuff that really you don't, we can use computers and calculators for at this point. And I think at its core, math as a subject is very universal. It's very fun and creative. And I just wanted to sort of present that to people.
That's Milo Beckman. We talk with him about his book, Math Without Numbers. And then we go from math to astronomy as we talk with science journalist Giles Sparrow about his new book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and Three Imposters. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. For the math challenged like myself, the idea of doing math without numbers is attractive. But isn't that like writing without words? Not at all, at least according to my guest Milo Beckman. In fact, the higher orders of math are done without any numbers at all. But you don't have to be a mathematician to understand the math in Beckman's book, Math Without Numbers. Charmingly illustrated by M. Erazo, it's a conversational guide to the three main branches of abstract math, topology, analysis, and algebra. And it's surprisingly easy to grasp. Math Without Numbers upends the conventional approach to math, inviting you to think creatively about shape and dimension, the infinite and infinitesimal, symmetries, proofs, and how these concepts all fit together. Milo Beckman has been addicted to math from a young age. A math prodigy, he was captain of the New York City math team by age 13. His diverse projects and independent research have been featured in the New York Times, 538, Salon, The Huffington Post, The Economist, and others. Milo Beckman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
I was so intrigued by the title of your book, Math Without Numbers, because that's the ideal kind of math for me. I confess that I think it's called dyscalculia.
Yes. Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
Some people are dyslexic. Well, that's what I am with math. I struggle with simple arithmetic, actually, although it's gotten better over the years. So tell us, why a book about math without numbers?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm actually really glad you said that you have like dyslexia for numbers, because I actually have something kind of similar. And I think a lot of people who have, I mean, numbers just don't come that naturally, I think, to the human mind. I remember reading some study that in sort of surveys of traditional cultures, everyone has a concept of 1, 2, and 3, but then there's not always a concept of 4. There's sometimes just like many after a certain point. And just intuitively, like, you know, our brains can't comprehend the difference between 1,000 and 1,000,000 and 1,000,000,000, and certainly not the difference between like 1,012 and 1,013. Like, that stuff is not really meant for human consumption. And I was always really interested in sort of more the patterny theoretical aspects of math. I was very fortunate to sort of have this extracurricular math experience where we get to talk about like shapes and dimensions and infinity and all this stuff that was really interesting to me. But I always really actually struggled with the numerical aspects of it. So I was on math team and I would solve this like really complex problem. And then I would get to the end and it's like 7 plus 2. And I would just like write 10 or something. It just doesn't click in the same way. And so I just want people to know that you don't have to be super comfortable. You don't have to be like a mental calculator in order to understand and be actually really good at math. And I think the way that our math education system is set up in the US, but also in a lot of places, sort of to make you feel bad if you can't do that stuff that really you don't, you know, we can use computers and calculators for at this point. And I think at its core, math as a subject is very universal. It's very fun and creative. And I just wanted to sort of present that to people who may not have gotten the same experiences that I did.
So, I mean, this is, of course, the subject of your book, and we'll get into it more deeply. But how can you do math without numbers?
Yeah, so the idea for this book came because when I, you keep doing math for longer and longer, and you go to college and grad school and you're doing math, and eventually there's no numbers on the board anymore. This, it hit me this one moment when there was like a professor filling the board with like symbols and stuff, and there's just no numbers at all. And I was like, wow, people really don't understand this. People really get trapped at the like long division part. And I wish there was a way people could just jump over it and see this cool stuff that we're doing here. And I also, again, I struggled with, you know, when I was reading the textbooks for these things, they, you know, they do a very precise job of explaining concepts, but they don't do a very intuitive job. And so I can like read a page and it'll be like, oh, a manifold is a locally Euclidean topological. And I, you know, I'm just, you're flipping back and forth. Like, what does this mean? What does that mean? What does this mean? And then you finally get it, like an hour later, it clicks. And you're like, well, why didn't you just draw me a picture of the damn thing? And so I really just wanted to show people sort of a visual, like museum tour of interesting math concepts. I think these days with like Instagram and YouTube, people are familiar with some of these things. Like maybe you've seen some fractal zooms, or you've seen some of these cool, like artistic looking math things. I basically just wanted to go through some of my favorite math concepts and explain them intuitively and how they sort of all click together.
You say something in the book that sounds, well, I'll just say it. You say fundamentalist mathematicians believe that everything, plants, love, everything can, in theory, be understood in terms of math. I have a feeling that in theory thing is pretty important.
Right. Right. And I've actually had people argue with me in both directions about that quote, where you have some mathematicians say, oh, why are you calling us fundamentalists? Everyone should know this. It's trivial. All math can explain anything. And then I've had people on the other side be like, what are you talking about? How could math possibly explain love? Even in theory, it's not possible. And so I tried to, with this book, I'm trying to sort of bridge that gap between these hardcore mathematicians that I sort of grew up around and the general public, who I think tends to have a very unfortunate perception of math based on our education system, based on maybe some evil math teachers they had growing up. And I sort of want to present this worldview that mathematicians have, this sort of way of looking at things, this lens that helps you process and analyze things and think slowly and clearly and carefully about the world. I wanted to present this to the general public, to people who are, whatever, didn't study math, don't want to study math, or are young enough that they haven't decided to hate math yet. But I don't want to sort of beat people over the head and be like, oh, math is everything. You have to be a mathematician when you grow up. It's the most important thing in the entire world. And so that's sort of the goal here, is to bring these two groups together.
You know, I didn't hate math as so much feel that I was locked out of a language that I couldn't understand.
Yes. Yeah. I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I think that's actually really important. The culture of math is extremely exclusive. I think it's extremely exclusive against women and also against Black and Brown students. The sort of extracurricular math world that I was very fortunate to be a part of was very male and very white and East Asian. And, you know, it's a fun world, but I just wish that it was made more open to other people, because there's a lot that we're doing inside that math world that I think makes it exclusive. And it's not just about the content of the math itself. It's the culture around it. It's sort of like whatever, the chess games and the Frisbee tournaments and stuff. And there's a whole culture around it that I wish was a little bit more open. And so, it was really fun for me. My favorite reviews that I've gotten of this book are just like random, like 14-year-old girls on Twitter being like, 10 out of 10, loved it. It's just, I wish I had seen this earlier. That's really rewarding to me, because that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Well, that's great. So now tell us how you did approach that. In this book, Milo Beckman, in Math Without Numbers, you say that the secret about real math is that you can study anything at all as long as you lay out the rules of the game ahead of time. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so math is really about sort of making up your own worlds. There's a famous quote from, I think the name is like Janusz Bolyai, a Polish mathematician, who said, I don't know if he's Polish, I might have made that up, but said, out of nothing, I've created a strange new universe. And I really like that quote, because that's how I feel about math. Basically, you set up some rules or some definitions. So you say, you know, okay, I'll just start with the first question that I asked at the beginning of the book is, how many shapes are there? Which is a very broad, open-ended question. You might not think that there's an answer to it, But basically, you know, you can start defining your terms a little clearer. Okay, what are we defining as a shape? When are we going to consider two shapes the same or different? And you get to set the rules, right? You get to decide what you mean by the question. And then once you've set those rules, it's sort of not up to you anymore. And that's what's always really exciting to me about math. I used to like doodle in my notebook. If I was bored in class, I would just sort of start making up little math problems or math worlds. And the fun part is like you can make up a question and then just not know the answer. And you can talk to your friends about it and they cannot know the answer. And then you can have these questions that are just open questions for the entire world. That's something I like to talk about in this book, is there are a bunch of math problems that have never been solved. And they put out like $1 million prize for anyone who can solve it. So it really is just about sort of setting up this little game and then trying to play with it yourself and see what you can do with it. And what's really interesting is that sort of the paper and pen seems to like respond back to you. It's not like a monologue. It feels like a dialogue with something. And that's always been really fascinating to me.
And now you say, as you mentioned, there are math problems that have not been solved.
Yeah.
Talk about a mathematical proof, because you say that is the process of math. That's a basic.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I think the world would be a lot better off if we all sort of had a better understanding of what can constitute a proof or what is sort of like a reliable proof. I think we get by in our society with a lot of like, I said it, and because I'm the principal of this institution, therefore it must be true, right? There's sort of a lot of going based on authority. And the idea of math is that anyone has equal say, as long as you're using these sort of logical structures. And the question is, okay, then what logical structures are you using? And that gets like deep into the philosophy of it. And there are a lot of questions people ask about, well, is the math that we've invented the only math that can exist? Are there lots of different versions of math that can exist? That's something that I talk about later in the book in the dialogue section. There's like a little debate between someone who's sort of what you might call like a fundamentalist mathematician, who says math is completely universal, universally true, everything about it is completely objective and not based in culture. And then you have this sort of contrarian or someone asking questions, and this is based on students that I've had in the past who are sort of like, well, wait a minute, is this culturally specific? You know, why are all the names that I'm hearing about in these classes white men? You know, where does this stuff even come from? And I want to spell that out because I do think there's been a political effort in the last couple hundred years to make math into this sort of like upper class European thing, when really, I mean, numbers, what we call numbers, our Arabic numerals were invented in what we now call the Middle East in around the like 800 to 1100s. But of course, everyone had a way of doing math. Every different culture had a way of doing math. You know, there was the abacus, there was like knots and strings. Everyone has some form of accounting and bookkeeping, astronomy, gambling, architecture, you know, there's geometry. You have to have some way of analyzing the world around you carefully and trying to do things with it in an organized way. And so I do think it's all sort of like different languages, different translations of the same underlying thing, these sort of patterns of the universe, whatever it is. And that to me is something that, you know, is worth thinking about at least.
So let's talk about one of those underlying things, or at least one of the ones that you start with, and that's topology. You mentioned shapes. You start with shapes. Tell us what topology is and how can a circle and a square be the same shape?
Everyone asks me that question. Are a circle and a square really the same shape? So topology is kind of like a goofy version of geometry, is kind of where I'm at with it right now. Geometry is about measuring shapes and angles and lengths and stuff like that. And, you know, if you've probably taken geometry in school and you have to do things like calculate exact areas and stuff like that. So topology is a way looser version where basically shapes are made out of like silly putty or like gum or something, and you can stretch and squeeze them. And so a circle is the same as a square because you can just kind of pinch those corners in and suddenly it's a square. But a circle is not the same thing as a line, because no matter how you try to stretch and squeeze a line, if you're not ripping it in, you know, you're not like sort of like cutting it in two pieces there or one long linear piece. And if you're not squishing it or gluing it together, like flattening like that, you know, if you stick by those two rules, no cutting and no gluing, then a circle cannot be made into a line. And so this question of how many shapes are there is a way more interesting question in topology, in this kind of loose version. than it is in something like geometry or, you know, however else we normally think about shapes. So we're just sort of breaking up shapes into these broad categories. You know, a circle and a square are both just like a closed loop. There's this really nice illustration by my fantastic illustrator, Amorazzo, early on in the book where you see a necklace and you can sort of move the necklace around into whatever shape you want. You can sort of hold a necklace like a square. You can hold a necklace like a circle. You can hold it like a pentagon if you really want to. But, you know, no matter how you hold the necklace, you can't turn it into an X shape, right? And unless it's like looping back on itself or you're cutting it into pieces or something. So it sort of gives weight to this very basic question, how many shapes are there? And that question ends up being one of these unsolved questions that people have spent hundreds of years now trying to figure out. And they actually recently wrapped up a big chunk of the question in 2005. Someone won $1 million prize for basically almost finishing up the third dimension. Three-dimensional shapes is almost done now.
Could you make a necklace into an infinity sign?
You can, but only if you're manipulating the necklace in three dimensions. So if you're sticking to paper, you're going to have that crossing point in the middle, an infinity sign or a figure eight or whatever. You're going to have that little X point in the middle. And that's not, you know, no matter how you stretch and squeeze it, you can't get rid of that little point. So if you're dealing with something on a piece of paper, which when we're dealing with two-dimensional shapes or, you know, shapes made out of sort of this line material, this, you know, like a string type shape, you imagine them being on a flat surface like that.
So now we're at three dimensions. Tell us about the dimensions.
Sure. So dimensions, people talk a lot about like the fourth dimension and fifth dimension, and they try to confuse you and be like, oh, there's higher dimensions beyond our perception. But actually, dimensions are a very common thing that we talk about just in daily life. It doesn't have to do necessarily with like physical shapes. One example that I like to use of this is politics. So we often talk about politics as being on this sort of left-right axis where you have people who are really far to the left, people who are kind of in the center, people who are far to the right. And that's kind of like a model of political ideology. It helps you understand a little bit what's going on. It's not a perfect model. Clearly, there's more to it than just that. And so sometimes people add another dimension to it, right? So maybe you have a left-right economic axis, and then you have an up-down like authoritarian libertarian axis. Maybe you have an axis on views on race, an axis on views on gender. And as you keep adding these different directions of difference, these sort of different directions of motion, you have now a very high dimensional space. You're not going to be able to draw it physically as a map anymore, as you would if it's like a two-dimensional or one-dimensional space. But you can theoretically imagine what it's like to talk about, I don't know, a 12-dimensional space where there's just a whole bunch of different factors that go into understanding these things.
Yes. And well, that makes a lot of sense to me. And you've also described a continuum in some ways. So talk about continuums.
Yeah, yeah. So that's another sort of topological question, is this difference between something being a binary versus being a spectrum, right? So people right now are talking a lot about that in terms of gender. That's a sort of hot topic, is we sort of used to think, or some people used to think, that gender is a binary. You have the male dot and the female dot, and they're separate from each other and there's nothing in between them. But now we sort of understand that at the very least, there's this kind of one-dimensional spectrum of gender where you have non-binary people in the middle, you have people who are more feminine, more masculine. And maybe honestly, maybe there's more to it than that. Are there two dimensions of gender? Are there three? You know, any topic you want to think about, there you can think about, is it a binary? Is it sort of discrete, is the word we use in math? Is it like separate, like but? Or is it continuous, something more like shh, where it just blends into each other, right? So that's the difference between like a binary and a continuum.
I love the way you converted a visual image into an audio.
I know. I had to do that there's an audiobook version of this book, which was such a struggle because, as I've stressed a couple of times, there's like 200 illustrations in this book. It's extremely visual. And so for me, the whole fun of it is you open to a random page and you're like, what does that mean? Let me read about that. And so when we were trying to convert it to audiobook, there were so many points where it's like, oh my God, what am I going to do here? How am I going to get her to like explain this? And so for the discrete versus continuous, that was what we settled on, is doing sort of a sound version of it.
Oh, that's perfect. Now, of course, there are other kinds of dimensions that, you know, we talk about in physics that I've never been able to wrap my mind around.
Sure.
And you say in this book that the in Math Without Numbers, Milo Beckman, you say that the universe
mm-hmm.
might be a shape we haven't thought of yet.
Yeah.
And so explain that and then link that to the ideas about time travel and wormholes and things like that.
Totally. Yeah. So going back to the politics thing for a second, just because I feel like that's a great sort of way into this. If you're thinking about politics on, let's say, just a one-dimensional left-right spectrum, sometimes people ask the question, well, is it really like just straight left to right where you can keep going left forever and ever and ever and you can keep getting further and further left? Or maybe is there like an endpoint on both sides? Is there sort of like a true left position, a true right position? Or sometimes people even posit that maybe it's a circle. Maybe if you go too far to the left, now all of a sudden you're back on the right-hand side. And so even once you have the dimension of a shape or a space, you don't know everything there is to know about that space. And that's kind of what these million-dollar questions in topology are about. We've finished it up for these kind of linear spaces. We've finished it up for these two-dimensional, like sheet-like spaces and three-dimensional spaces almost. But there's just so much more when you're talking about if you're modeling something with 12 dimensions, well, we have no idea what shape that is. Could it loop around? So in physics, right, we tend to model the universe as either three or four dimensional. It has three spatial dimensions. You can look around and see that yourself. And then as of like the 1910s, we sort of tend to think of time as a fourth dimension. But then you could ask, well, is time a linear thing that goes on forever towards the future? Is there an endpoint to time? Or does it even go in a circle? Does it loop back around? And if you just wait it out long enough, we're going to be in the past again. You know, all we know is that locally, looking at it right now, it seems to be a one-dimensional thing. Time seems to only go forward and back. You can't really go left or right in time. But that still leaves open a lot of questions about what the actual shape of time is. And then this is going to get beyond my head pretty quickly, but there's a whole bunch of stuff in relativity and physics where the time and space dimensions actually kind of, you know, mush into each other. They kind of are, there's like, they like twist in this weird way called a Minkowski space, where moving in time and moving in space are kind of related to each other because of this like speed of light stuff. And, you know, at that point you're saying, okay, if we do live in a four-dimensional universe with three spatial dimensions and one time dimension, well, which one is it? We don't know necessarily. We have some models, but we're not done classifying all the four-dimensional spaces. So it's actually very possible that the shape that this universe actually is one of the ones that hasn't been discovered yet.
Well, that's so interesting. And I have to go back to your political, because you just sparked an idea in me, which is that it goes back to the idea of having to decide what the rules are ahead of time. Because let's say if you think of that left and right axis, and if you think of the one that's just one, you know, one dimension, it just goes either, you know, it's a line basically, and that it has an end. I would imagine, you know, in that one, it might be, say, the rules of the game are how much people talk about responsibility to the whole versus the responsibility just to the individual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's what's really fascinating about it is political scientists try to model this thing, right? You try to ask people questions. You can do one common one in sort of election politics is what they call thermometer rankings. So you can ask people like, oh, what are your opinions of Bernie Sanders on a scale of 0 to 100? And you sort of do this for a bunch of different people, and that kind of places people. That, of course, is very dependent on individual personalities. But yeah, people ask all these kind of like social survey questions, what you're talking about, where you sort of try to understand people's level of commitment to communitarianism, you know, how much you think the collective is important versus how much you think people should be focused on the individual. But there are a bunch of ways people try to model this. And again, yeah, it's very much about how you set the rules. There's this very popular model in political science called DW Nominate, which is what's used on, for example, 538 or the New York Times, or, you know, when you're trying to measure what a senator's views are or a representative's views are, and you're trying to predict how they're going to vote on a bill. Everyone uses the same model that was just invented by these two people. And there are obviously limitations to that model. There's limitations to any model. And, you know, in like 2016, there were starting to be some issues where it wasn't giving accurate predictions for certain elections. And so, again, you know, that's what's important about setting the rules at the beginning accurately. If you're trying to understand the real world, you want a good set of rules that are going to give you something useful to work with.
Well, no kidding on that, on those predictions. So here, by contrast, let's say, you know, a lot of people, and I think it's more like a superficial or a cute idea, but the idea that you can circle around, that you go so far left that you actually become right. And, you know, and there are people who say, well, it's like Stalin and Hitler. Yeah. But then you'd have to actually be employing a totally different kind of factor, maybe one that had more to do with power.
Yes, and centralization versus decentralization. Politics is an extremely complicated subject. My feeling is if you actually were trying to do like a real accurate analysis of people's political ideologies, you would need like dozens of dimensions. So people are inherently going to be approximating when they're doing political science.
Well, that's great. That's so interesting. And, you know, I think you have proven, if we can say proven, math is interesting. Math is true. This, you say this in the beginning of the book, and useful. And I think what's so interesting, you know, you've just shown us how useful these abstract ideas are in the real world. So I wonder if you could talk about algebra, because algebra you discuss as, you know, kind of the most abstract realm. Talk about that and how is that useful to us?
Before I say that, I will say, in terms of just the usefulness of math outside of strictly speaking math and science, I always found, once I sort of started exploring academically and professionally outside of math, I always found that when I walked into a room and I was like, hey, I'm a math guy, no matter what room you're in, people are kind of like, oh, thank God. You know, we need someone to sort of apply these ideas. So, you know, again, my hope is whatever you're interested in, whoever's reading this book, is that it'll spark some ideas for sort of your projects and your fields, and you'll be able to use these concepts and ideas and apply them. So for algebra, I should first say that mathematicians use the word algebra to mean something kind of different than school algebra, which is the, you know, X plus Y equals Z kind of stuff. When mathematicians talk about algebra, I don't know why they use the same word twice, but you're sort of talking about this the concept of structure and order in the most abstract way. So a very famous algebraic structure is, let's say, the structure of a social network like Facebook, where each person is represented by a node, you know, just like a dot on, and then if two people are friends, you just draw a line between those two dots. And so you can imagine thinking of a social network as this web of dots and lines connecting dots. And, you know, then you have something like Twitter, where instead of being a sort of bi-directional line between the dots, you have a one-directional arrow of this person follows that person. And so those are two different algebraic structures. One is called a graph, the other is called a directed graph. But there are so many different algebraic structures you can use. You can have like a weighted graph where some people are more friends with each other and some people are you know, just acquaintances. You can have a family tree is a type of algebraic structure. There's really no limit to what you can do, again, if you just set the rules how you want to. And so when you're learning algebra, abstract algebra in a math class, you might be staring at this thing being like, why the heck would I ever need to use this particular structure? And then, you know, I just was interviewing with this person the other day who studied math, and he was like, I never thought I was going to use any of this stuff. And then like day two of my job in some like computer place, I clearly don't remember the details, but he had to use this like very abstract algebraic structure to model something that was going on with their users. And so these things a lot of times are invented just for fun, just kind of like doodling on paper, as this book is trying to put, you know, make front and center. But then inevitably, these sort of abstract structures and ideas end up being useful for modeling real world things like politics or users or whatever.
And you say algebra is about relationships. I mean, it's about structure, but it's about relationships. So say more about that.
Right. So, you know, like the structure of a social network, the example that I was using, is all about relationships between objects. If you just have some collection of objects, there's sort of not much you can do with that. and like really the substance of language and thought and just making claims and sentences in general, you know, whatever you're talking about, is you're not just talking about objects. You're not just being like, book exists, microphone exists, computer exists. You're being like, okay, the book is to the right of the computer. The book contains images. You're sort of drawing these connections between things. And that at its core, if you really want to get down to sort of the basic basics, is an algebraic process, talking about the relationships between objects and how they fit together.
Well, there is that and so much more in your book, Milo Beckman, Math Without Numbers. This has been an illuminating conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Francesca. I really love getting the chance to talk about this book on general writer platforms because that's the most fun for me. I like sort of slipping this stuff into people's mind.
Milo Beckman. We link to an excerpt from Math Without Numbers at writersvoice.net. Next up, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Love Writer's Voice? Sign up for our free podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. On a clear evening, if you look up, you can see thousands of stars shining in the dark sky. Each has a story of their own. Taking 21 stars and three imposters that aren't technically stars, science writer Giles Sparrow offers a complete introduction to what's happening up in the night sky. We talk with him about the universe from its birth to its death and much in between, including that mysterious thing, dark matter. Giles Sparrow writes about astronomy, science, and other cool subjects, and is a regular contributor to magazines including All About Space and The Sky at Night. Giles Sparrow, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
You say pretty much up front that those pretty lights in the sky aren't just there for decoration. So what are stars for?
Well, I guess it's a matter of faith whether you think that they're for something, but in terms of like the reality of why they're important to us is, you know, fundamentally we wouldn't be here if it weren't for stars, and not just on a level that obviously all the light and heat that, you know, warms planet Earth and makes it habitable comes from the sun every day, but, you know, on a deeper level, you know, most of the atoms that make up our bodies have been processed. Stars, basically, they're kind of, you know, factories that turn, you know, nuclear furnaces that really turn the very lightest elements in the universe, hydrogen and helium that were made in the Big Bang. They gradually transform them into heavier elements like oxygen and carbon and the things that make up our bodies. And so apart from the hydrogen and helium, which there's not much helium in our bodies, but apart from the hydrogen that obviously is quite a major component of water, most of the atoms in our bodies have gone through a few generations of stars to get to us.
Do you know, this is a question I've had since I was a kid, and I'm sure, you know, I really think most kids do have this question. You mentioned the Big Bang. Does anyone understand at all how something could have been created out of nothing?
There's various theories, and it seems like it's possibly, it may not be that, you know, whether there's something that's being created out of nothing in the end. I mean, the classic theory and the way we kind of think about the universe is that everything is expanding and moving away from each other, and the space itself is stretching apart. And you can trace this expansion back to 13.8 billion years ago, where everything would have been in the same place at the same time. And if you kind of rewind the clock of the universe, you can think about the fact that as you jam more and more stuff into a smaller and smaller space, collisions are going to become more common, so things are going to heat up. So you can say, okay, we started with this very hot, dense state, and that's the Big Bang. But you can't really go back. There's a fundamental thing in quantum physics which ironically we're going from talking about the scale of the universe down to the very smallest scale of atoms and things. And there's a size below which the laws of physics that you kind of, we can model things on larger scales, you know, they really just cease to apply. And it turns out that for the first 10 to the minus 43 seconds of the universe's age, it would have been smaller than this Planck length, we call it. And so we can't really apply laws of physics to that period. So it's very tricky to imagine what came before, because the thing is, time itself was created in our standard understanding. It was actually created in the Big Bang. So there really just wasn't anything there for it to come from. But having said that, there's this increasingly popular idea of, they call it eternal inflation, which is this idea that perhaps there is this underlying nature of the universe is that it is this hot, dense state, and that it occasionally lets these little bubbles that burst out and become universes. So they start expanding. So, you know, and the universe may take hold, and if the conditions are right, it'll grow up and become something like our own universe. And if it doesn't, you know, if it's just wrong, then it may either tear itself apart or just collapse back, a bit like a bubble popping into existence and then popping out of existence again in a fizzy drink. And so this is another idea that maybe the fundamental nature of the universe is that it's creating, or the multiverse, I guess you could call it, is creating all these separate universes, of which ours is just one. And then that kind of problem almost goes away of where that energy comes from, because you just think, well, it's there all the time, and that's how it kind of works, which is a fairly mind-blowing, bit of a mind-boggling opener, I think.
Well, it's all pretty mind-boggling, but that's so interesting. And, I mean, that's more information than I've ever had before about this. And so you're saying it's possible that there's more than one universe?
Yes, potentially, because, you know, the universe is, you know, essentially it's an expanding bubble of space and time. So if you think about it, it's a bit like if you imagine an inflating balloon. Yes, that's the usual thing. The usual analogy is to kind of throw away one of the dimensions, and then you can think about space being the surface of the balloon, and that it's expanding outwards and things are moving away. But there's no real reason why there shouldn't be other balloons that could be popping up in different places. And there's theoretical ways that you could potentially detect, you know, where one of these other universes was impinging on our own, if its bubble of space started to come into our own, then you might get weird effects. And one of the weird things is that, you know, depending on exactly what conditions are there in these different universes, you could have very different laws of physics, really, because most of the laws of physics just come down to the exact, you know, values of a fairly small handful of constants and, you know, yeah, fundamental constants of nature. So things like G, which is the universal gravitational constant, and that's what fundamentally determines the strength with which gravity operates and pulls things together if they've got mass. And so you could have different universes with different gravity, and that could have, if one of those started coming into our universe, that could have interesting results. But they haven't got to the point yet where they think they have detected such a thing. But yeah, this general idea that maybe our universe is just one of many is a get out clause for the very question you started by asking, which is, well, where did it all come from? In some ways, rather than explaining why there's just this one universe and it happens to have these, you know, fairly amenable conditions where you can have long-lived stable stars and life. You know, so perhaps it's easier to address that question by saying, well, there's actually just lots of universes and we happen to be in one, rather than there being, you know, having to set a whole load of special conditions for why our universe is, you know, the one and only.
Wow, that is mind-boggling.
there's a thing called the anthropic cosmological principle, which is this based on this whole idea of, is the universe, you know, the universe appears to be made for life because of the fact that we're here and we're able to observe it. And, you know, that we have to take this into account whenever we're observing the universe around us. We have to take into account the fact that we're not just in any universe. We're in a universe that's, you know, that has long-lived stars that can live for billions of years and generate these heavy elements and give rise to life.
So now back to your book, Giles Sparrow, back to A History of the Universe and 21 Stars and Three Imposters. Why did you choose these 21 stars? What was so special about them? And give us some examples.
Well, it's the idea of the book has been sort of bugging me for, you know, quite a long time. I've been sort of mulling it over. I've done lots of books in the past that have been, you know, big illustrated books, you know, with lots of these gorgeous Hubble photographs. And I just thought, well, what if you can boil it down and how much of the way the universe works and indeed the story of astronomy, can you tell with what's the minimum number of stars you would need to tell that story? Because I always think it's nice. I do also write about, you know, or have written about the constellations and practical stargazing. And I do a monthly column in a UK science magazine on exactly that kind of side of things. And I always think it's nice to marry the two up so that really, if you can point at a particular star in the sky and say, okay, this is that particular star and this is its story and how we learned about it and what it tells us about stars more generally, then I thought that's an interesting approach and a way that you can actually really get a handle on the subject matter instead of just looking at a photograph of an object that you don't necessarily associate it with being something that you've seen for yourself. So I guess I set out to work out how few stars I could really tell the whole story in, and I came up with this number of 21, and then kind of in order to round out the story and tell, you know, fill in some bits of the wider universe, I had to cheat with these three imposters, which are things that look like stars but actually have eventually turned out not to be. And then on top of that, I wanted them to be as much as possible objects that you can see from most parts of the world and you can mostly see with the naked eye, or at least, you know, binoculars maybe, but not. I didn't want to have too many things where it was something very obscure that you'd need a large telescope to go chasing after. There's a couple, unfortunately, again, to tell the complete story, but most of it was this selection. And then on top of that, there were just some particular stars that have such pivotal roles in, you know, how we've come to understand the universe, that because I wanted to also tell these stories about astronomers and, you know, how we've learnt these things, I guess I wanted to include those ones in there as well. So, for instance, there's Mizar, which is the star in the middle of the handle of the Big Dipper, the plough, as we would call it in the UK. But it's that very famous pattern of seven stars. And if you look at it and think of it as a handle and then a dipping bowl or pan, and the middle star in the handle is, if you look at it, you know, you can spot that it's got another small star next to it with your naked eye. And then if you look closer with binoculars or a telescope, you'll see that Mizar itself is also a double star. And this was one of the first double star system to be discovered. And it's since, we've just learned so much about studying it that we've got, you know, we now know there's six stars in this system, all in orbit around each other at various different rates. Some of them we can separate with binoculars or telescopes, and some of which we only know from other ways of studying light. And I guess another of my favorites is very obscure, but it's a star called 61 Cygni, and it's kind of tucked behind one of the wings of Cygnus, which is the Swan constellation, which is a very bright, you know, cross of stars you can see kind of flying down the Milky Way you know, with its beak towards the south on summer nights, heading south, and just tucked in behind its wing, there's this very small star, but it happens to be, or faint star, but it happens to be particularly interesting because it's the very first star that we were able to measure its distance from Earth by a series of fairly clever math tricks. So that's an interesting one. And then we have, you know, other stars like, you know, Aldebaran, that is the eye of Taurus, the bull, and Betelgeuse, which is this famous red supergiant star that's on the shoulder of Orion, the hunter. And that was in the news as I was writing this book, because it dipped, you know, in brightness suddenly. It's been stable. It's wobbled a little bit in brightness for a long time. And then it's suddenly, in late 2019, early 2020, its brightness kind of, you know, gradually it started to fade, and sort of it drops for the first time ever out of the top 20 brightest stars in the sky. And it's now becoming brighter again. And they think that it let off this enormous cloud of dusty gas that temporarily blocked some of the star's light from view and is now coming back into view. So we've got stars like that. And yeah, there are many, many stars, 21.
Giles Sparrow, tell us a little bit about our galaxy. I was surprised to find this out, but then what I don't know about astronomy could fill volumes, that our galaxy is anchored by a massive black hole. So tell us, first of all, what is a black hole, simply? And are all galaxies anchored by black holes? And how do they know that there's a black hole there?
Well, to start off with, a black hole is fundamentally, it's anything. We tend to think of it as a single dead star. Usually the classic black hole is when a really massive star runs out of, you know, fuel, that basically this fusion process, this nuclear process I was talking about earlier on, holds it up and supports it and stops it from collapsing in on itself. And when it runs out of fuel, the core of the star collapses, and it collapses so much, it becomes so dense that its gravity is so strong that even light cannot escape it. If you think about, Earth has a what we call an escape velocity, which is how fast a rocket has to be going in order to escape Earth's gravity completely. And it has to go at 11.6 kilometers per second, 7.7 or 8 miles per second, if I've got my figures correct, but don't hold me to that, but around those kind of figures. And so light can escape from anything if it's this escape velocity is less than, you know, well, the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. And a black hole has gravity that's so strong that its escape velocity is higher than that. So even light cannot escape it. And usually we think about them forming from collapsed stars, but you can, in theory, if you get any mass of, you know, gas, dust, you know, any kind of cloud of stuff that is able to collapse on itself to that extent, you know, you can get a black hole. And we think the black hole at the center of the galaxy has got a mass of about 4.3 million suns. So it's this enormous thing. And the way we've discovered, you know, that it's there is by using, we think about the Milky Way as this, you know, this band. Everyone experiences the Milky Way as this band of stars wrapped around the sky. And that's really, we're looking across the plane of the disk of our galaxy, and stars are kind of piling up behind each other. And you can't see, ultimately, that there are so many stars that if you look towards the core of the Milky Way, you struggle to see past them. But if you use infrared cameras and on telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope, you can see stars that are very close to the very center of the Milky Way. And, you know, one of the ways that we can tell is because they are moving at incredible speed. And the heavier the object is, that something is, if something's trapped in an orbit, then the more massive the object that it is orbiting is, the faster it has to move to stop being pulled inwards. And so we can see that there are these stars around this central, you know, they're orbiting around something that doesn't emit any radiation really that we can see. And yet they're circling or going in ellipses around it in a matter of a few years. And they've been able to actually track the positions of these stars circling around this thing over several, you know, over a couple of decades now, and have found that, you know, not only they can estimate that it's got 4 million suns worth of mass to explain why these stars are moving so fast, but they can also constrain the size of it and say, okay, it's got 4 million suns worth of mass, and they're jammed into a space that's kind of smaller than the orbit of Uranus around the sun. So, you know, sort of smaller than our solar system or most of where the planets orbit. And the only way you'd ever get that kind of mass in that smaller space is if there's a black hole there. And so we think that, yeah, we think that there are these black holes in the center of, you know, pretty much every galaxy we see, because most galaxies formed billions of years ago. Anything that's orbiting too close to the black hole is going to have been pulled in and pulled to its doom long ago. We think about black holes as these kind of cosmic plug holes that are pulling in everything from their surroundings. But if you're far enough away and you're moving fast enough, then you can just keep your distance and have a stable orbit around it. So that seems to be what's happening, and most galaxies have long since kind of come to terms with the fact they've got this thing there, and it acts as an anchor. And so stars orbit around that, and then more stars orbit around them, and ultimately then, you know, we are sitting in our solar system about 27,000 light years from the very center of the Milky Way, and we're orbiting around this hub with the, you know, not just the black hole in the center, but the billions and billions of stars that are surrounding it and are also orbiting around that. And they make this huge mass that's, you know, that then holds our own solar system in place.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Giles Sparrow about his new book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. So we started this conversation talking about the beginning of the universe. You end this book by talking about the end of the universe, and there have been some new developments as we have begun to understand something more about dark matter and dark energy. You know, in the time we have left, tell us about dark matter, dark energy, and why that has upended so many theories about what's happening to the universe and its fate.
Yes. Yeah, dark matter is this fascinating thing. When we measure, you know, as I was saying, the speed at which the solar system orbits around the center of the Milky Way and other stars orbit around the center of the Milky Way, we find there's this strange pattern that really, you know, despite this black hole and all of these stars, we're still orbiting it much faster than can really be taken into account by the mass of all of the stuff that we can see. And so we think there's, you know, this is evidence that there's about, you know, five times as much dark matter, which is stuff that is, it's got mass, so it exerts gravity and means that, you know, we move under its influence. But it's not just dark. It's not just that it doesn't give out light or any other form of radiation. It's also transparent. It doesn't interact with light, so light shines through it without really leaving a trace. And so there's this idea that there's about five times as much dark matter in the universe as there is luminous matter. And we have to take that into account when we think about the rate the universe is expanding. So, you know, for a long time, there's been this question about, you know, what's the fate of the universe? Is it going to keep on expanding forever from the Big Bang? Will it pull back on itself and gradually its own gravity slow its expansion? Will it slow it to a halt? Will it even pull it back on itself, so we end up with something like a big crunch in trillions of years' time? And yeah, so the very last star in the book is an example of what we call a supernova, and it's a particular type of supernova that always goes off and emits the exact same amount of light and energy. And we think that these things, you know, in the late 90s, astronomers came up with a very clever idea of using this to actually double check the rate at which the universe was slowing down. Because if you look at a very distant supernova and you know how bright it should be, then if it's brighter than it ought to be, then you'd think, okay, it ought to be, it's an indication that the universe has slowed down and there's less space between it than you might, between us and it, than you might think. But instead they found that the universe is actually expanding over time, at least in the past few billion years. It's not been slowing down as you might expect as the energy of the Big Bang unwinds. Instead, it's blowing up at an ever-increasing rate. And this has given this idea that there's this dark energy component. We call it dark energy. Nobody really knows what it is, but it's something that's causing space to expand at currently, at least at an accelerating rate. So that may, if it lasts, then it probably seals the fate of the universe that we are indeed going to carry on expanding forever.
Right. And stars will expand, and ultimately solar systems will expand and disintegrate. And then ultimately our own atoms will, if anything like us is still around in those trillions of years, will also disintegrate.
Possibly, yes, if it keeps getting stronger and stronger. I mean, that's one theory. It seems to have got stronger over the past few billion years, and we don't know if it'll flatten out, but if it carried on getting stronger and stronger and stronger, then it would make itself felt on smaller and smaller scales. And yes, it could start tearing galaxies and solar systems and indeed, you know, individual atoms apart. That's a scenario called the Big Rip.
Well, we have to end there. This has been so interesting, and it's just touching the surface, really, of this book, A History of the Universe and 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. We didn't really talk about the imposters, but listeners will have to read the book to find out about them. Giles Sparrow, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thanks for having me.
Giles Sparrow. You can find a link to more of his work at writersvoice.net. And tune in next week for a very exciting program. We talk with tech sociologist Sherry Turkle about her wonderful memoir, The Empathy Diaries. Then Michaeline Duclef tells us about her terrific book, Hunt, Gather, Parent, What Ancient Cultures Can Teach Us About the Lost Art of Raising Happy, Helpful Little Humans. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.